Hello and welcome to Learning College. I'm your host, Alex Linder. I'm of VNNforum.com and the planet known as Earth. In today's discussion, we are going to examine a comparatively brief chapter, chapter 6, called Liberal Guilt Cookies, of E. Michael Jones's seminal Degenerate Moderns. Modernity is Rationalized Sexual Misbehavior. This being chapter 6, we've already done the introduction and 5 chapters, which you can all find at vnnforum.com in our The Massive file in the audiobooks thread. Now, earlier chapters, Jones tends to mix one short one with one long one. We just got done with a very long one about Kinsey, the fellow who concocted / compiled bogus sex data and was found useful by the Jews ruling the U.S. in spreading lies about human sexual behavior in order to change that sexual behavior, to kind of fake it till you make it, think, well, you're not, well, everybody else is doing it. Why are you so weird that you're controlling yourself? You see, that's Kinsey. And before that, we had a much briefer chapter, I think one of the best ones, Chapter 4 on Stanley Fish, who Jones went to grad school under, at least for some courses, and a good discussion there. Or Chapter 3, Sir Anthony Blunt and homosexuals and how they're innately conspiratorial, how they're trying to network and change things, and how that played into communism in Britain, in Bloomsbury in England in the 30s. And then we had the very start, the first couple of chapters, we had the coverage of Margaret Mead, Cultural Relativism, with the best-known, most famous disciple of the Jew who founded social anthropology, that is, dishonest anthropology, as a way to take the focus off real comparative cultural disagreements and bone study found in physical being, meaning bones and such, an actual artifact, relics of original anthropology that Jews perverted when Franz Boas and others came into the country. And they sent Margaret Mead abroad, and on the basis of very little and very weak research, she concluded that free love was culturally normal in Samoa. Now, it wasn't, as was further revealed by Derek Freeman decades later, but nevertheless, as with Kinsey, that lie was used to attempt to change what Americans believed about their own culture. Yeah, you really need to loosen up, man. Now, why would Jews do that? Because the troublemaking Jews, the nation-wrecking Jews, they've been known for nation wreckers for 2,000 years, believe that sexually unsettling and morally unsettling society is a way for them to come into the fullest social and political control possible. The Nazis are the most evil men in history because they figured that out and stopped them in Germany for a time and space until they were crushed by an international network created by Jews precisely to do that. But the left-wing Jews that Hitler drove out of Germany came over to the U.S., reset up their Frankfurt school, Frankfurt because it was originally in Frankfurt in Germany, reset it up in Columbia in the U.S., and then later it moved to California, I believe, but they concocted various studies, the most famous of which was called the Authoritarian Personality, which purports to find that whites are inherently authoritarian, and that equals anti-Semitic, Jew critical, more neutral term, and they need to be drawn out of this anti-Semitism by A, making them go away completely through genocide, through multiculturalism. That's the longer term plan. But the shorter term plan is to sexually loosen them up with stuff like MTV and reality television and bogus sex studies. You attack them from all fronts, from popular culture, but also from lies and politics masquerading as science, as we discussed earlier. Anyway, these are the earlier 5 chapters we've done and the introduction as well. Degenerate Moderns, Modernity is Rationalized Sexual Misbehavior, Introduction, Why Modernity is Rationalized Lust, Why Biography is Destiny. And this is Jones's eternal theme, that people dream up these bizarre schools in order to justify sexual misbehavior, in order to justify immoral activities on their own parts. And he pursues this in every single area, from architecture to psychology to anthropology and on and on. Anyway, chapter 6 we'll begin with today is just a brief chapter, 7-8 pages. It goes from about 117 to 126 and proceeds a very long chapter on Picasso that we'll get to later in the week. But so it's almost more of an interstitial dealing with a brief thing, as he had that section dealing with the Leonard Jeffries, the sun and ice theory. And again, this book was the book that shot Jones to international prominence, or whatever fame he does have. Published back in 1993, so concerning political correctness and debates back then. The entire book, because I always like to give you the truest perspective in matters small as well as large, the entire book is 259 pages. There is no index to it. We have now done 116 pages, so we're getting on towards about 40%+. After this, we'll be at 126, so yeah, we're getting on towards just a little shade under 50%, and we will at least do Chapter 6 and Chapter 7 this week, and we may do even beyond that, but we'll get it done within the next couple of weeks. As I write to you, it's now June 1st, and we've probably got 100 hours or so of the Learning College already up, and we're going to be having a lot more as the turkey hunting social season is finally drawn to an end here in the Nemo. The Nemo's Northeast Missouri, for those of you unfamiliar with probably the most important part of the world. Why is it the most important part? Well, not it's first, it's the turkeys, but second, it's because we are having a genuine, high-level, illiberal arts discussion such as is not available in any public school or any college or any graduate school in the land. We are reading the books that need to be read and talking about them in the ways that need to be talked about, which does not even include the author's perspective. Well, it includes the author's perspective, but the author doesn't have the final words. Otherwise, I would simply read the text. Now, Jones's lessons, Jones comes from a traditional Catholic perspective, can be applied from the white point of view, because we don't have to agree with Jones's thesis. We can find elements of it to be true, but nevertheless, we know that Jews are bent on eliminating whites for racial reasons. They may use the techniques that Jones describes, but they are doing it for racial ends. Jones isn't interested in that because his religion and the dogmas that he accepts and perpetrates hold race at essentially no value. Now, we racialists look at it very differently. We think race has a very big value. But nevertheless, what Jones is talking about in terms of making connections among these Jews and showing how they use the various matter of the epiphenomena, what happens from day to day and day to day life, and how they overtly do these things through higher academia is very useful to us. So we thank him for what he's provided, and we use it and we apply our own existing knowledge in the way that Hitler indicated in Mein Kampf. We fit it in to give a clear with what we already know, to give us an even clearer picture, or if we find something that contradicts what we've heard before, then we have to settle that, so that overall everything that we know forms one clear, coherent picture, even if it's merely of like, we don't know what's here. We haven't filled this in yet. Still, we continue steadily to expand what we know. And this is our Bildung, is a very important concept in German, sort of the character, moral, and intellectual internal growth of ourselves as a person in the deeper, truer, real sense of self-actualization or self-realization as we come to develop our abilities. And that's what the Learning College is about helping you do. And it's not about debt or drinking and partying and getting drunk or football games and falling off balconies. It's about purely learning. Let's get to it. Liberal Guilt Kilkeys, Chapter 6 of E. Michael Jones's Degenerate Moderns from 1993. Jones says, "It was the kind of article you've seen 100 times before on the women's page of the local newspaper. The only intriguing thing about it was its title, something about guilt cookies," in quotes. literally Gilk cookies. From the recipe that was given, they seem like just another type of cookie. Their name derives from the effect they are to have on the conscience of the mother who bakes them because she is going on a business trip, quote, leaving everyone at home to eat the cookies and to wonder, you imagine, whether they will still love you after you've left them in the lurch for 3 whole days. A few dozen chocolate chips are all that stand between you and total abandonment. Okay. So, I'm just testing my sound levels there. The author, you may have gathered, doesn't like business trips, or at least so she says. I suspect that there's more ambivalence here than she is willing to admit. In another column describing one of those business trips, she tells us, I like the snap, crackle, and pop of those momentary encounters. I wouldn't want them to become extinct. I cheated some weeks ago on an airplane when I struck up a casual and friendly conversation about computers with the man across the aisle. But to get back to her original column, she doesn't like business trips, quote, because I have to leave my children. And when I call long distance, the older one croons, are you coming home tonight? Which breaks my heart. Now, we think that mothers staying home with their children and eschewing the climb up the corporate ladder is a good thing. When it comes to moral issues, we are not exactly hypoactive. However, even admitting that, we know of no sin involved in leaving one's children, provided they are well cared for 3 days. If the children are neglected as a matter of course, that is another matter. But a 3-day trip? One wonders why the guilt, especially in an age that is so adept at rationalizing and shifting burdens and making excuses, especially among the feminists, to which class our author belongs, or one wonders at the guilt, given that it's so uncommon these days. When there are so many other things that are so wrong and so routinely condemned, why feel guilty for something like this? It was the sort of thing that is mildly puzzling and then soon forgotten amidst a welter of seemingly more important questions. But then, as if the lady were insisting to answer a question you weren't really interested in asking in the first place, the answer came 2 weeks later in the same column. The column this time was on abortion. On abortion, we are told, in case we were tending to think otherwise, we really can't ever go back. The occasion for writing this column was Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun's then-recent statement that Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision allowing abortion, finding the national right to it in the penumbra of the emanations from one of the Bill of Rights, when in fact it was outlawed basically across every single state before then. If it were left up to the democratic will of the people, as with affirmative action, as with border controls, it would never have been improved. The occasion for writing this column was Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun's, a noted liberal, then recent statement that Roe v. Wade, the 73 decision allowing abortion, would probably go down the drain during the court's next session. Needless to say, the author is not happy with that prospect, although as with most feminists these days, she can't wax enthusiastic about abortion anymore either. Quote, once you know the truth, you can never go back, close quote, she writes, quoting someone. The phrase tells the truth, of course, but in a way the author doesn't intend. And why isn't our author happy? After talking about how we can't really go back, she tells us, millions of us have had them ourselves. She is, of course, referring to abortion. Finally, at the end of the column, she writes, I am one of a generation of women who, since the time they became sexually active, have had access to legal abortion to change those scenarios. We have discussed, we have agonized, we have changed our minds and changed our minds again, but I do not believe we can ever go back. Is our author, her name is Anna Quinlan, a semi-famous public figure back then, typical op-ed writer, trying to tell us something? Most of what we hear in the realm of public discussion on the abortion issue seems curiously disconnected from personal biography. We are led to believe the furor over abortion is something as abstract as rights, as if all of this were thought up in some seminar somewhere and then spread around by people who were ravished by the cogency of the logic involved. Now, it turns out that in the real world, things are different from that. People support abortion for much more mundane and understandable reasons. One of the main reasons is conscience. Supporters of abortion have often had abortions themselves. Political activism becomes a synthetic painkiller for pangs of conscience. It is to spiritual health what treating cancer with anesthesia would be to medicine. So again, Jones is coming at this from a Catholic moral perspective and claiming that anyone who's had an abortion basically feels bad about it or traumatized by it, and to overcome this feeling of having done something very terribly morally wrong, they engage in political activism. That's certainly true of some. Is it true of all? I don't know. That being said, however, as we move on to page 119, there were still some puzzling things about the abortion column. Notable by its absence, for example, was any mention of guilt. Now, it seems odd that a lady who is plagued by hyper-scrupulosity when she takes a 3-day business trip, so much so that she has to bake ritual guilt cookies to absolve herself, should be able to bang out an abortion, a column, an article on abortion without so much as a moral blip appearing on the screen of her conscience. Let's pause a moment here. Scrupulosity is a Catholic, it's a minor sin of being exaggeratedly obsessed with morality. In fact, I personally think all Catholic morality tends toward what they define as narrowly as scrupulosity, exaggerated fears like, oh, I went to sleep at night and my eyebrows pressed in the pillow and murdered an entire generation of eyebrow mites. You know, that'd be an excessively exaggerated moral concern. But he's pointing out that she's straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel when it comes to the morality of leaving your kids for 3 days versus the morality of murdering one in the womb by an abortion. So that's that concept of scrupulosity is what he's driving off there. It's not just a word. It has a specific meaning within Catholicism and their moral system. But maybe it's not so odd at all. Maybe, I began to feel, the sort of ingratiating supermom of column one is related in a more profound way than we would initially think to the pro-abortion advocate of column two. The connection has to do with guilt. I have no doubt Ms. Quinlan feels guilty. I just don't think this guilt has to do with 3-day business trips. I know that there are people with scrupulous consciences, just as there are those whose consciences are lax, but in general, people feel guilty because they have done something wrong. Guilt is to the soul what pain is to the body. It is a sign that something is wrong. It is a sign that it is time to seek help. Now, just as there are those who try to ignore what their body is telling them because of fear of the doctor's diagnosis, there are those who want to ignore guilt, pretend that it isn't there, or there because of irrational psychological causes, anything it would seem, rather than face up to the fact that they have done something wrong. Ms. Quinlan is involved in what has become a common phenomenon these days, plea bargaining with her own conscience. By pleading guilty to a lesser offense, she hopes to get off from a more serious one. Instead of facing the source of the guilt, she tries to make people like her, figuring, I suppose, that if enough people like her, she can't be so bad, and therefore the things that she has done that now trouble her conscience can't be that bad either. The upshot of this tortured moral logic is large doses of sentimental and desperately ingratiating self-absolution. In airports, she tells us, I make a pathetic figure, smiling at toddlers, offering to hold babies, worrying silently about whether children watching planes take off, their foreheads pressed against the observation windows, could possibly break through glass 2 inches thick. Close quote. A troubled conscience is a formidable social force. It can become the hidden engine that drives entire cultures. Like the devil himself, the more its existence is denied, the more powerful it becomes. People plagued by guilt really have only two choices. They can adjust their behavior to suit their morality, or they can adjust their morality to suit their behavior. End of the paragraph. Notice again that it is not Anna Quinlan who has said anything about feeling guilty about abortion. It is Jones inferring that wholly on his own, saying that if she feels guilty about leaving her kids for 3 days so much that she bakes cookies and has all these worries in airports, then surely something 100 times worse, abortion, literally murdering a kid, must be causing her immense pain, so much pain that she can't even acknowledge it, and she sublimates it into this this other garbage. Again, that's his view. She doesn't say any of that. The first option, and again, as Jones will often likes to say, you can conform truth to desire or desire to truth, so it is with morality. You can either alter your behavior to fit in with your morality, or you can alter your morality to justify your behavior. The first option, that is, conforming your behavior to morality, the first option is generally known as repentance. In the history of mankind, this option is rather new. It really only came into vogue with the advent of a man by the name of Jesus Christ, who lived in the Middle East some time ago. This man also claimed to be God, which is why he had the power to put some force behind the whole notion of repentance. Jesus Christ, according to those who knew him at the time, not that they wrote about it at the time, had a hard time convincing people of the time that he had this power, so to show them that he did, he would produce some parallel visible sign, something like curing people of paralysis. Christ figured, I suppose, that if people could see the undoing of physical paralysis, they would extrapolate to the undoing of moral paralysis, a much more serious but less visible malady. The only requirement for forgiveness was belief in Jesus Christ and the admission that the person was sorry, which entailed the oftentimes unspoken admission that what one had done was wrong. As the teachings of Jesus Christ caught on, this forgiveness became institutionalized in what the church called a sacrament known as penance, capital P, or confession, capital C, or in its latest appellation, reconciliation, with a capital R. So penance, confession, or reconciliation are repenting of wrong and attaining forgiveness. Whatever its name, the elements remain the same. Faith in Jesus Christ as God, coupled with the admission that the action one had committed was wrong, in the context of the sacramental arrangement of the church, that is their formal, ritualized way of dealing with this process. Say you go to confession, and then they absolve you or give you some spiritual work to do to make it up for the wrong that you admit you've caused to go on. In the context of the sacramental arrangement of the church, brought about the forgiveness of that sin and the removal of guilt. A certain sense of freedom followed that was unlike anything the world had ever known. So you do something, you feel bad about it, you repent. And the neat thing, the Protestant here would kick in somewhat laughingly, is that you're free to do the whole thing again tomorrow. And we had Donald Day in the other book that we read, Onward Christian Soldiers, talking about the Polish peasant girl on the church steps as she's coming out of a confession, and he imagines she's confessed to some sexual sin, and she has a delight because the sin is now lifted, and she knows damn well she's going to do it again. And this is the Protestant, or Jones would probably say, undoubtedly say, wrong and cynical view of it, but I'll leave that to you to judge. And here's an example of what education is. I don't tell you what to think. I tell you what this fellow thinks. I give you some additional perspective on it. Sometimes I throw in what I think. Other times I make what I think clear with my tone. And you must infer what I think. Now here you might be able to guess what I think, but I don't feel any particular need to state it outright at this point. I just point out that there's nothing to prevent you from doing the same sin again and again, and the Catholic justify. He not only has a solution, he has the justification, because the Catholic will laugh at notions of self-improvement, yet in his system, because we're fallen, that is, basically justifies every crime that we commit. Well, we have a fallen nature. God created us this way. All we have to do is ask for forgiveness and we are forgiven and reconfirm our belief in Jesus Christ as God. And that's enough to be forgiven, even if we're a mobster who chops someone's head off. We're still alleviated of that sin. We can go and sin much more. And every single time we can get out of it free. But the Catholics don't look at that as such a big problem as others might. A certain sense of freedom followed that was unlike anything the world had ever known. If you want an idea of what the world is like without this possibility of forgiveness, study any primitive culture, as of, say, the beginning of this century, with its fears and taboos and propitiations to implacable gods and forces constricting these cultures into a cultural analog of the paralyzed man before he was told to pick up his bed and walk. The ancient Greeks, a group close to us in culture, if not in time, are a good example. They had a whole art form based on the world without forgiveness, which is to say an unredeemed one. It was known as tragedy, the essence of which is that you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. If you want to be an upright guy like Pentheus in the Bacchae, B-A-C-H-A-E, that's where we'd get baccalaureate and bacchanalia, I suppose, or Hippolytus in the play of the same name, and choose not to become sexually involved with, say, your stepmother, you inevitably offend some god or goddess who arranges it so that you get trampled to death by your own horses or torn limb for limb by your mother's corybantic feminist friends. Now let's pause there to go into word meanings a little bit. Corybant was a priest. Looking it up, I've come across this before, but I'll be honest, I didn't remember what it meant. But corybantic means wild or frenzied, referring to orgiastic rites of the priests of the Phrygian goddess Cybele, C-Y-B-E-L-E, or Cybele. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, but anyway, it means so wild or frenzied is what corybantic as an adjective means. And he's saying again, So he's saying, then the older pre-Christian where there is no redemption, you may try to live a moral life, but inadvertently you may offend some god or goddess who arranges it, quote, so that you get trampled to death by your own horses or torn limb from limb by your mother's corybantic, wild, frenzied, feminist friends. Such is life in a world not redeemed, which is to say, without Jesus Christ and the church that he founded as the way to salvation for all men. Now, here again is a good chance to practice what the meaning of thinking is. What is the alternative view to Jones? What is wrong with Jones's view, or how would you come up with a critique? I've already suggested part of it, but let me suggest a second part to it. It's the lightness of what Jones is saying. He's saying that's a good thing. It lifts this off the human heart, and we can feel good again and go out there and not be eternally cursed by what we've done. The alternative view, though, might be that you're turning humans into Mylar balloons. You're removing the gravitas of their individual decisions by saying that they can so lightly do wrong and then be relieved of them. And you're also essentially denying that external events, that we are not purely the products of our own choices, but we are subject to the choices of others, whether those others be other men or other gods. It may be true that we're to define ourselves by how we react to what happens to us, but I think there's a little bit of lightness in the loafers that creeps in with this concept of redemption. Ultimately, what you did, I believe, cannot be erased, cannot be lightened, and you have to find a way to live with it forever. And if it crushes you, and many times it does crush people, that's not necessarily the wrong reaction. Sometimes we should be crushed by foul stuff that we've done, even to the point of taking our lives. But if we desire to go on and reform our behavior, we can do that also. So we can hold in mind that we have done things that were objectively nasty or bad or wrong. Maybe not in an absolute sense, but in a comparative sense, in that, you know, we believe that we ought to live this way, and we lived out of line with that in this particular, or for this stretch of time, But no, I don't think that you can lift it. And see, here I go directly into my own view. I don't think you can lift what you've done. What you've done is what you are. I mean, it doesn't mean in any way that you can't change what you do going ahead, but neither can you so lightly get rid of it as walk into a church and talk to some old pedophile called priest and say, "Oh, I did. Oh, that's okay. You're lifted. You have faith in Jesus. Your sin is expunged." And go on out there and yeah, you know, I know because you're a fallen nature, you're going to sin again. I mean, this is it's not the way I look at things, but it is the way Jones looks at things, and this is his story. So we'll keep going here. But as I was saying, repentance is not the only option, although it certainly was attractive enough to men to spread Christianity throughout the entire world. Well, it's attractive because it's easy. The primitive pagan mode isn't much of an option anymore either. As Ms. Quinlan might say, once you know the truth, you can never go back. The third option is the option of the Antichrist. It is the satanic option. It is the option of rebellion, the attempt to turn deliberately away from the truth and make wrong right. I use the term advisedly. Quote, evil be thou my good, unquote, is the quintessentially satanic attitude. As we move on to 121. Satan, if we can believe John Milton, said it himself, knowing good and evil, that's a quote, being, quote, like gods, unquote, is something women have found attractive from the beginning. It is no wonder, then, that the women's movement should fasten on these goals now. But as Ms. Quinlan's columns indicate, Plan B doesn't quite work. This thing called guilt is an elusive but persistent commodity. If we repress it in one area of our lives, it pops up somewhere else. If we refuse to acknowledge the atoning power of Jesus Christ and the immutability of the moral law his church propounds, we find ourselves not free from guilt, as the propagandists would lead us to believe, but enslaved by it, consumed by it, succumbing like the most ignorant and benighted savage to ritual acts of propitiation, things like baking guilt cookies and writing columns about it, trying to convince the world and yourself that you are a likable person. And again, he's inferring every last little bit of this. She didn't say she felt guilty at all for having an abortion. She felt guilty for leaving her kids for 3 days. So you have to keep this in mind, that he's building this house himself. Guilt, as Ms. Quinlan's columns indicate, is a powerful force in the world today. Someone, I believe, even came up with a term to describe its political application. The term is liberal guilt. Just about everyone has heard of it, but no one seems to know where it comes from, where it came from. Ms. Quinlan, and we can be thankful to her for this, gives us some insight into the state of mind at its origin. Generally, it is assumed to be some sort of free-floating psychopathology. However, now that we know the true nature of liberalism, that explanation no longer suffices. So liberalism was assumed to be some sort of free-floating psychopathology, that is some psychological defect or pathology always means disease. But now that we know the true nature of liberalism, that explanation doesn't suffice. Take the case of Ms. Quinlan, whose columns, by the way, have been collected into a book, Living Out Loud. She was born in 1950, Philadelphia. So she's kind of one of Jones's contemporaries. He was from around there. And raised a Catholic, another similarity to Jones. But by the time she graduated from Barnard College in 1974, she seems to have converted to the religion of Zeitgeist, spirit of the times, known then as now as liberation. Liberation in this time frame came first as sexual variety and then as the woman's variety. In fact, the one led to the other. So she's kind of a raised Catholic, became a feminist with the sexual and feminist revolutions. It is my contention, backed up from evidence gleaned from Ms. Quinlan's columns, that the net result of any movement of this type of liberation has as its natural concomitant, as something that runs along with it, an ever-increasing pool of guilt. The reason should be obvious, but let's deal with them in the chronology of the generation Ms. Quinlan represents. First of all, there is apostasy. the turning away from God, specifically Jesus Christ and the church he founded. Such a turning away is the raison d'être, the reason for existing, of education at places like Barnard. So he's saying colleges like Barnard are specifically intending to drive people away from Christ. In fact, one might say that all modernity, all the creators of the intellectual artifice that is the modern age, were bent on nothing more than a rationalization of apostasy, with sexual rebellion as its vehicle. So he's counterposing sex and religion and saying the modern age, which is primarily Jewish, is trying to drive people away from the church in the vehicle of sexual permissiveness, sexual rebellion, sexual liberation, as it's variously called. What do Margaret Mead and Bloomsbury and Picasso and Sartre and Freud and the various forms of socialism and Paul Tillich and any number of lesser lights have in common? Precisely that. Rationalized sexual misbehavior construed as liberation. In reality, it was nothing more than an attack on God in general, and the Christian sexual morality in particular. Like the rest of our generation, Ms. Quinlan stepped onto the slippery decks of Catholic education at the height of the storm. Like many of the rest of us, she was swept overboard. Add to apostasy. Apostasy is turning away from the true religion. It's a concept that you'll read a lot in the Dabiq, the ISIS English language magazine. They're very hot to denounce any. Just as an example to meaning the word apostasy, any Muslim who doesn't go along with their particular sect or their particular definitions is an apostate and needs to be beheaded. So Jones is talking about apostasy from Christianity and Jesus Christ, his God. Add to apostasy the sexual sin that follows almost automatically therefrom. Modernity, as I said, is nothing but rationalized sexual misbehavior anyway, his subtitle and thesis of all of his work. And then add the abortion that follows naturally from the sexual revolution, and you have, after a while, a pretty impressive pool of guilt, one big enough to form the basis for a political movement. This is precisely what has happened over the past 20 years or so. Guilt has not only become endemic, it has become a powerful political tool. And, you know, again, Jones can be questioned. Right at the very time he's writing this, or right before, I had gone out to D.C. after graduating from college in 1988, working in professional conservatism for about a year, and then working in other business journalism. But while I was in D.C., I went to several of these big abortion rallies, at least two of them, not to participate, simply to watch and make observations. And I recall, this is actually what turned me against abortion. I sort of thought of it as an individual right up to that point, but I'd never written about it. I'd never truly thought about it. But I realized I was on the other side when I saw this giant banner, and behind the banner were all the leading lights of the leftist, and most notably it was Sybil Shepherd and this stupid, smug look on her face that turned me against abortion. I just inherently realized, like, she can't be right about this. I mean, abortion to me, at least, is a fairly serious matter. I mean, you're going into the womb. And, you know, I was raised Christian Science, and that drove me. That only ratcheted up my inherent desire for reality against delusional fantasy. And so, at the very least, abortion is clearly murder. That doesn't mean it's necessarily bad or wrong. In my view, if you're going to abort non-white children, that's perfectly fine, because they'll just grow up to be criminals and useless. I'm not a Catholic. I'm not a Christian. I don't think that God created every last nigglet on earth and that they all have an imperishable soul of unquantifiable, inestimable value. I don't see them as all these little black pearls or brown pearls. It's great if they're aborted. We're lucky there aren't 30 or 40 million more blacks crawling around. Things would be immeasurably worse. But the Christian position would be that an abortion is an abortion. It's all murder. It's all immoral. It should all be banned. But anyway, in these gigantic, probably the biggest pro-abortion rallies ever ever arranged, I would have to guess. They were absolutely gigantic. I sat there and I watched all the freaks and the leftist and the crazy right wingers protesting them. I mean, because it turns out a huge response at the same time, just a human cavalcade, not of whimsy, but of just craziness. And seeing the reason I'm going into all this is to say that if those people feel guilt, it sure wasn't evident on their face, because all the women pushing pro-abortion are basically upper middle class women who are essentially glib, flat-minded, very selfish and self-satisfied in that bourgeois way. If you grew up, I grew up bourgeois. I don't know. Many of you did. Many of you probably did not. Grew up more working class, but just incredibly self-satisfied. As I think of that, even today, burned in my mind. You know how certain things burn into your memory, probably 100 different things over your life. Just a smug, self-satisfied bourgeois look of I'm so. And he's saying they feel guilty. I don't know, man. I didn't see any guilt. I really didn't. So I'm questioning what Jones is saying, that these people really truly feel this guilt over it. I'm not sure that's true. In general, they're pretty light thinking. They may be smart. They may be talented. I mean, Cybill Shepherd is certainly a good actor. She's a very good looking woman. I think her character makes her unattractive, but objectively, physically, and professionally, there's nothing wrong with her. She's qualified, but I seriously question that these people feel guilt. Jones is reading their minds, is what it is, based on his very slippery Christianity and its extensive but unproved, unbacked claims. So always keep this in mind. The fact that someone wrote a book and put it out doesn't mean that they're right. Doesn't mean you have to believe them. Doesn't mean they're beyond questioning. The fact that someone is right about one thing doesn't guarantee he's right about something else. At best, it might make it more likely. But always, you must do the final thinking for yourself and come to the conclusion. Don't take stuff on faith. That's my way of looking at it. So, but what Jones is saying is that there's two ways you can go, and to destroy the church, you need to promote doctrines of sexual looseness, and this is what college effectively does in the 20th century. And the minute you have sexual looseness, you have the need for abortion, you have the justification for abortion, and eventually you get abortion, even if it's against the popular will. And this is the key thing. When the Supreme Court found that right to abortion, abortion was legal nationwide. Even in the most left-wing states, it was illegal. And I believe they still say that if it's more or less the same, if there were a vote held on it, abortion would still be illegalized in almost every state, if not every state. Anyway, guilt has not only become endemic, it has become a powerful political tool. Liberalism, as currently practiced, is the politics of guilt. Guilt is the engine that pulls the liberal train. Now, see, I would say what pulls the train is Jews trying to racially destroy white society, and that promoting immorality and abortion and selfishness is part of that, because I see it as competing species doing battle biologically. But Jones doesn't see any of that because he doesn't look for it. He isn't interested in it. He thinks he has the key to understanding everything through his morality in his church, you see. So there are different ways of, he may see there is an overlap in the techniques that we see, but he ultimately traces them to different groups and different sources and different rationales than we racialists might. Liberalism, as currently practiced, is the politics of guilt. Guilt is the engine that pulls the liberal train. We all know that racism and anti-Semitism and misogyny are wrong. Well, we don't all know that, E. Mike. What we are interested in here is the political grammar of those ostensibly involved in right-wing in righting those wrongs. All the liberal causes are orchestrations, in one way or another, of the pool of guilt that has been building throughout this century. Again, I urge you to look around. Do people seem to feel guilty to you? I see much more fear and aggressiveness. I believe fear is the fundamental human orientation that can be overcome by some, but is always largely the driver in any given situation, just as it is with other animals. You ever notice, you look at any animal, any kind of animal, they're always looking around because there are things to be afraid of, and they have to detect them as early as they can. That's the basic animal situation, and I believe that's the basic human situation. And I think it's obvious. The Democratic Party is a good example of how all this gets brokered. The women blackmail the liberals who feel guilty about the sexual revolution, and the feminist power bloc comes into existence. The homosexuals blackmail the feminists who feel guilty about abortion and so compensate by allowing the homosexuals to become officially designated victims so that the feminists won't have to face the real victims, their own aborted children. Guilt becomes the power base for each of these movements. It becomes the medium of exchange in the political marketplace. In order to play, you must first get yourself designated as a victim. That is like passing go and collecting your $200. After that, you're on your own. And why does it work? Well, ask Ms. Quinlan. It works in direct proportion to the number of people in our society who turn away from Jesus Christ, the one and only effective antidote to guilt. It is simple enough to be reduced to an equation. The politics of guilt and blackmail will increase in inverse proportion to the number of people who follow Jesus Christ and, we might add, as he would, do his will. All of this only makes sense because the need to escape from guilt remains a constant in the life of human beings. If people deliberately turn away from Jesus Christ and the sacrament of penance, they will be forced to seek release from guilt by ritual actions like baking cookies before business trips. Unpersuasive, I find that. I think persuasive is that Jews used deliberately created the homosexual identity and deliberately altered, i.e. recreated, the feminist identity to serve their own anti-white agenda and mission. And I think that's pretty easy to demonstrate. Jones, do you really see a lot of guilt in these leftists? I don't. I see desire for power and desire to squash anyone who thinks differently. I don't think they feel guilty at all. And that's from having dealt with them. They mistreat you 1,000 ways. They certainly did to me, and they don't show any guilt about it. Their basic feeling is hatred that you're still existing. And you should die already. That they feel guilt. He claims it. I don't see it in the real world. I think he's wrong. Roussas J. Rushdoony, R-O-U-S-A-S J. Rushdoony is a fairly famous name, who is not a Catholic. He's what he was, but he's sort of a prominent preacher. A lot of what he said is pretty sensible, even if it's attached to the Jesus nonsense. But anyway, he's someone who, notice how this is what they mean by all great minds think alike, or all thinking minds, all minds that are thinking clearly are going to arrive at the same basic, not conclusions, but they're going to see the same things. They may feel about them differently, but they're going to at least acknowledge that they're there. You see. Roussas J. Rushdoony is the key word you want to remember. Rushdoony, R-U-S-H-D-O-O-N-Y. Strange name. I think it's Armenian or something. Roussas J. Rushdoony, who is not a Catholic, said much the same thing in a prophetic book published in 1970 called The Politics of Guilt and Pity. Now here's an extended block quote from Rushdoony, who is someone worth looking up. The reality of man apart from Christ is guilt and masochism. And guilt and masochism involve an unshakable inner slavery which governs the total life of the non-Christian. The politics of the anti-Christian will thus inescapably be the politics of guilt. Again, this is easily refuted. Confucianism. Chinese, they live for thousands of years by Confucianism, which is without this drama queen element that these adult white male Christians always see in everything. And it's looniness. It's not there. The politics of the anti-Christian will thus inescapably be the politics of guilt. In the politics of guilt, man is perpetually drained of his social energy and cultural activity by his overriding sense of guilt and his masochistic activity. He will progressively demand of the state a redemptive role. What he cannot do personally, i.e. to save himself, he demands that the state do for him, so that the state, as man enlarged, becomes the human savior of man. I kind of refute this myself, being atheist. I want the state out of everything. I want the state out of more stuff than Rush Dooney and Jones do. So I'm not sure where he's getting that. There are simpler explanations that cover the given facts, and it's that genetically a large percentage of the population, Jews for rational reasons, but a large percentage of whites simply want to boss others around and force fit them into a system. And you don't need any more complicated explanation involving this guilt that these people supposedly feel, but never themselves express, to explain it. But anyway, Rush Dooney is saying what he cannot do personally, save himself, he demands that the state do for him, so that the state, as a man enlarged, becomes a human savior of man. The politics of guilt, therefore, is not directed, as the Christian politics of liberty, to the creation of godly justice and order, but to the creation of a redeeming order, a saving state. Guilt must be projected, therefore, on all those who oppose this new order and this new age. Okay, that's the end of the quote. Yeah, it's true that the leftists do want a large state, and they do go around basically claiming everybody is guilty of racism or sexism or whatever. And it is annoying, but I'm not sure it's driven by the motives he says it is. I think it's not. In the interest of full disclosure, we add here that Ms. Quinlan is a publicly self-professed Catholic. She has even written a column called "I Am a Catholic," unquote. However, the kind of Catholic she is doesn't really change in any significant way what I've already said. She is one of that kind of Catholic, the kind that Father Andrew Greeley, he was a fairly big name writer back then in the 70s, feels confident endorsing sort of a sociology. I think he wrote some fiction too, but Greeley was a bigger name in the 70s and 80s. She is one of that kind of Catholic, the kind that Father Andrew Greeley feels confident endorsing on the dust jacket of her book, by the way. She is the kind of Catholic the New York Times would like us all to be. New York Times being Jews. But let her speak for herself, says Jones. Block quote from Quinlan. We are cultural Catholics. Catholicism is now not so much a system of beliefs or a set of laws, but a shared history. It is not so much our faith as our past. The tenets of the church which I learned as a child have ever since been at war with the facts of my adult life. I could recite parts of the Baltimore Catechism in my sleep. Do I believe those words? I don't know. What I do believe are those guidelines that do not vary from faith to faith, that are as true of Judaism or Methodism as they are of Catholicism, that people should be kind to one another, that they should help those in need, that they should respect others as they wish to be respected. So from an intellectual perspective, says Jones, which is important to someone who writes for a living, no, Ms. Quinlan's orientation lies somewhere to the left of Unitarianism, which is basically a sort of godless left-wing post-Christian pseudo-religion or semi-religion. I find my religion with my heart, she tells us in another column, sounding a bit like George Fox, not within the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church. Actually, Ms. Quinlan is a number of things, as reading her columns will show. She is a feminist. I would like to say that I became a feminist to make the world better for women everywhere, but in truth it was to make the world better for me. She is an employee of the New York Times, and she is Catholic. The simplest way to explain how these parts fit together is that whenever something crucial to the first two categories contradicts something crucial to the third, the offending item in the third gets lopped off and thrown away. She is Catholic insofar as being that remains inoffensive to the first two groups. So she is a Catholic cut to fit Jewish liberal modernity. So in I Am a Catholic, she wonders, quote, what does it, being a Catholic, mean now? For myself, I cannot truly say. Since the issue became material to me, I have not followed the church's teaching on birth control. I disagree with its stand on abortion. I believe its resistance to the ordination of women as priests is a manifestation of misogyny that has been with us much longer than the church has. Yet it would never have occurred to my husband and me not to be married in a Catholic church, not to have our children baptized. End of the quote. Ms. Quinlan is, in other words, a liberal Catholic. Liberal in quotes. Which means, of course, that liberalism is her prime intellectual coordinate. When it comes to issues that the world takes seriously, things like abortion, things that might threaten her status as a Times employee or a feminist in good standing, she sides with the world. This attitude is common enough. Jesus Christ knew about it too. There are many words one could use to describe it. Courage, integrity, and/or consistency are not among them, though. Ambivalence is the word that comes most readily to mind. It comes best to the fore in her attitude toward abortion. She tells us that, while a student at Barnard, she helped a fellow student procure an abortion. On the one hand, describing her own pregnancy, she writes, "I felt not that I had a protoplasm inside, but instead a complete human being in miniature to whom I could talk, sing, make promises." Perhaps Ms. Quinlan is of the opinion that only she carries a human being in utero. It is difficult to tell. Now, that's a delicious example of Jonesian humor. He can be quite a funny fellow. In fact, I wish he pushed that even farther. Perhaps Ms. Quinlan is of the opinion that only she carries a human being in utero. That's just classic female brainlessness or inability to apply rational rules across different cases. So she tells herself, well, her friend is just aborting a fetus, but I have a weird idea that I was actually carrying a little tiny human being. In the end, she decides that neither the pro-life or pro-abortion view is satisfactory. She opts for, you will be expecting this, something in the middle. And that is where I find myself now, in the middle, hating the idea of abortions, hating the idea of having them outlawed. For I know it is the right thing in some times and places. In the end, liberal Catholics are no different from just plain old liberals. In their picking and choosing what it is they will follow and what they won't, they become like the God that Eve wanted to be, knowing good and evil. Knowing good and evil in quotes. But the person who becomes his own God will have to provide his own salvation too. And that, as Ms. Quinlan discovered on her guilt-ridden business trips, is a tall order. Which mortal can tell us which of the Ten Commandments is no longer operative? And having acted on that, which of these people can relieve his own guilt? The corollary to what we said above should be clear by now. The society that moves away from Christ will be guilt-ridden, masochistic, and weak. In other words, liberal. Its politics will be the machinations of blackmailers masquerading as victims. Okay, if it's so masochistic and weak, why does it never give the other side any advantage of the doubt? It treats them as evil and suppresses and stomps them into the ground. Those are not characteristics of weak people. They could be characteristics of guilty people, although I've said I don't agree with that either, but I don't see how they're characteristic of weak people. The weak ones seem to be the ones on Jones's side. But then he would say, our kingdom is not of this world, or I suppose, or something like that. He has to find some place where they are strong, where the others are, because the others have the worldly definition of strength. The same thing is true of Catholic liberals and those who pick and choose. Dissent is the politics of guilt and blackmail as pursued in the church. The dynamics are the same. The liberal Catholic signs on by taking an exemption on the one aspect of the Catholic faith that sticks in his craw, usually something to do with the Sixth Commandment. And I think that's the one that has to do with thou shalt not commit adultery. This in turn creates a pool ready to be tapped by any theologian who is adept at handing out permission slips. The guilt creates a political opportunity. Guilt is the mobilizing factor behind dissent. Out of guilt, theologians get to build political empires. The transaction they are based on is quite simple. The theologian writes a permission slip for contraception, abortion, sodomy, etc., in exchange for the ability to harness your guilt to his political abstraction. Or his political apparatus. The theologian will be happy to grant you a permission slip if you are willing to identify yourself as a liberal Catholic, in quotes, i.e. one of his followers. So Jones is saying that basically, look, there's an all-time moral law. And he really believes that law that comes down from on high, and you can't pick and choose which parts of it you're going to obey. It doesn't work like that. And if you try to make it work like that, as the liberal Catholics do, then you're going to feel eternally guilty and seek to escape from this guilt by joining with others in a liberal, worldly, political cause. And you can believe that if you like, but I don't personally see a great deal of guilt in those people. And remember, she hasn't said one word about feeling guilty about abortion. The result in general is the religious equivalent of inflation. There's lots of religious currency out there, but it isn't worth anything. That is, there's lots of stuff. Pardon me. There's lots of stuff out there calling itself religious, but it's valueless. It's nice that a Catholic writer gets the audience that the New York Times commands, but if it's only to ratify the secular liberal agenda, what good is it? Well, it's good for the Jews operating the Times. Better know Catholic, they can mislead people about what Catholicism truly is in order to advance their Jewish agenda. They can redefine Catholicism to suit their purposes, which is exactly what they did best of all at Vatican II. But I would argue that Catholicism all along has been equivalent to liberalism in that it denies biology and it grants non-whites a moral value equal to that of whites, and hence sets us on the road to liberalism in the non-sexual areas. That's an argument for a different day, though. But anyway, what he's saying is right so far as it goes. She is basically, her Catholic identity is false, he's saying, and is yet useful to the Jews running the New York Times because they can present her as a way to warp other Catholic views on at least some, if not all, of the matters where they're trying to drive an agenda. And if they believe the way to genocide whites is to take over their society, and the way to take over control of their society is by preaching sexual and other looseness, then you have a reason for their wanting to promote what Jones is calling liberal Catholicism. We might call, as racialist, extra-liberal Catholicism or sexually liberal Catholicism, as opposed to where it's liberal in other ways, which I've already described many times. Better no Catholic presence at all than one that leads people to believe that one can be Catholic and support abortion. And he's quite right from his point of view, and it's equivalent to my saying better no conservatism at all than one that denies racialism, as the Fox News conservatism does today, and indeed leaps to call to Me Too the liberals and call everyone a racist and deny that race has anything to do with conservatism. All that does is distort and disclarify and make things unclear and set up underbrush hiding the Jew foxes that are attacking us, you see. Last paragraph of this chapter 6, guilt, liberal guilt cookies. So Ms. Quinlan's writing epitomizes the triumph of guilt as a political tool, both in the church, where the strategy is known as dissent, and in society at large, where the state promises redemptive power while at the same time succumbing to the machinations of those who are most adept at orchestrating guilt for political ends. Feminism, homosexualism, affirmative action, these are the debased coin with which we attempt to buy off bad conscience. Or, alternative explanation, they are philosophies, policies, and groups that are deliberately created, repurposed, but in any case oriented and operated by Jews in order to destroy whites. Yet as with all blackmail, payment doesn't make the threat go away, it only guarantees further threat. Social activism will not remove guilt. Only God can do that. The only way out of the morass of spiritual blackmail that dominates our political life in this country is by acknowledging that our sins, not our business trips, are the source of our guilt, and that the confessional, not the Congress, is the proper place to deal with them. So concludes chapter 6. And I think we made a number of good points. It's a good quick chapter. we'll move on to Picasso next. But all I want to say is if you think that those people are genuinely driven by guilt, go to, as I did in the early 90s when he was writing this, go to an abortion rally put on by the pro-abortion side, and you see if you think that they feel guilty. I don't think they do. Let's leave it there. I want to thank you for being with me again today. I'm Alex Linder. I'm on Twitter at, oh my gosh, I can't even remember my name. But right now I have a chartreuse serpent as my avatar. And you can always find me. Vargas set it up so that at VNN, if you look around, you'll find Twitter. I think he's even got a strip at the a floating stream at the top on our index page at vnnforum.com. And that's where you'll find all these different episodes, these different hours that we do of The Learning College, as we call it, or Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. So thanks for being with me again today. I hope you learned something, and share the URL with other people if you want them to learn something. And I will be back with you again real soon.